KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
What Putin wants is a recognition by the United States that Russia has a right to a sphere of influence.
Ahead of another potential round of peace talks between Ukraine and Russia, we talked to one expert about what Vladimir Putin's goals are. For Sunday, June 1st, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. President Trump is cracking down on higher education and on international students. We'll hear from a scientist in Europe who's working to bring young scientists there instead.
We have bright minds that don't know what will be the next years in their lives. We should give them a hand.
Plus, what really makes a summer movie, and we talked to an extreme athlete about an unprecedented swim around Martha's Vineyard and why he did it.
The water was very cold. There were constant waves. And then you've got this constant thought about what is beneath you.
Those stories after this newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Hurst. Police in Boulder, Colorado say multiple people are injured or facing life-threatening injuries after receiving reports of a man setting them on fire this afternoon. From member station KUNC, Emma Vandenhende has more.
Boulder police got initial calls from witnesses saying there was a man with a weapon throwing gas and setting people on fire at an outdoor pedestrian mall, where a march was taking place in support of Israeli hostages held by Hamas. Chief Stephen Redfern says it would be irresponsible to speculate on motive now, but safety is his number one priority.
If that motive was a group was targeted, we will absolutely step up and ensure that additional security, additional presence. We want people to feel safe no matter what they're here for.
Police have taken an adult male suspect into custody. He was also taken to the hospital to treat minor injuries. For NPR News, I'm Emma Vandenhende in Denver.
The Senate returns tomorrow as President Trump demands they support his massive spending bill. NPR's Luke Garrett reports the House passed the so-called One Big Beautiful Bill Act, but some GOP senators say the current bill won't pass their chamber.
A handful of Republican spending hawks in the Senate are casting doubt on a bill that would enact President Trump's domestic agenda of cutting taxes, increasing border spending, and scaling back safety net programs. Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin told Fox News he supports Trump, but this bill fails to rein in U.S. spending.
My loyalty is to the American people, to my kids and grandkids. We cannot continue to mortgage their future.
And Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky told CBS News the bill is too expensive to pass.
I think there are four of us at this point, and I would be very surprised if the bill at least is not modified in a good direction.
If the Senate makes changes, the bill would have to pass the House again before reaching Trump's desk. Luke Garrett, NPR News, Washington.
Today is the start of the Atlantic hurricane season. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports forecasters are warning of an active season.
National Weather Service forecasters predict above normal hurricane activity this year, following a very busy 2024 that brought 18 named storms. This year, forecasters say the Atlantic Basin could see 6 to 10 hurricanes, half of which could be major, with winds topping 110 miles per hour. NOAA says several factors are at play, including reduced trade winds and warm ocean temperatures that fuel tropical storms. Formation. The Atlantic hurricane season opens amid staff cuts at FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, which the Trump administration has considered eliminating. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
U.S. futures contracts are trading lower at this hour. All three major indices are down around 0.3%. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Disposable vapes are now banned in the United Kingdom. NPR's Lauren Freyer has more from London.
This ban is part of an effort to curb youth vaping and cut down on electronic waste. Data show a quarter of 11 to 15-year-olds in the UK have tried vaping and 1 in 10 vape often. But some reusable vapes are almost identical to disposable ones. And so Hazel Cheeseman, head of an anti-tobacco charity, tells the BBC that this ban might just encourage youth to switch types of vapes rather than quit.
Teenagers weren't drawn to these products because you could throw them away off. They were drawn to them because they were brightly colored and they were really, really available.
And she says those things are still true for reusable vapes, which remain legal. The UK government is separately weighing legislation to phase out cigarettes altogether and extend smoking bans to more outdoor settings. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, London.
At the weekend box office, Disney's Lilo and Stitch took the top spot again, with an estimated $63 million in ticket sales. The hybrid live-action movie has made $280 million, and it's the second highest-grossing film of this year so far. In second place, Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning, with $27 million. It's taken in $353 million globally. That movie cost a reported $400 million to produce. In third place, Sony's Karate Kid Legends debuted with $21 million. The movie brings back Jackie Chan and Ralph Macchio together to train a new kid. Rounding out the top five, Final Destination Bloodlines with $10 million and Bring Her Back with $7 million. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Ukraine hit more than 40 Russian bombers with drones across multiple airfields in Russia today. That's according to a top Ukrainian official. The attack took place as Russia launched more than 470 drones at Ukraine. All of this just before the latest round of ceasefire talks are set to begin tomorrow. At the heart of the talks is a big question. What does Russian President Vladimir Putin want? He's talking to President Donald Trump about peace talks, but also ordering the most widespread violent and aerial attacks on Ukraine in years. And that and other things has led Trump to criticize Putin more and more in public, a step that has been rare over the course of Trump's two terms in office. To sort this all out, ahead of this latest round of talks, we called up an expert, Angela Stent. She studied Putin and Russia extensively. She's a professor emeritus at Georgetown University and author of the book Putin's World, Russia Against the West and with the Rest. Welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be on your show.
Let's go back to 2014 here at first and that initial invasion of Crimea. What were Vladimir Putin's goals then and how have they changed over the years?
So his goals then were certainly to take back Crimea. He claimed it was because he was concerned about, quote unquote, NATO ships appearing in Crimea, even though NATO had in 2008 had said that one day Ukraine would join. It had made absolutely no progress in doing that. So it was to take over Crimea and then destabilize Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we get the full scale invasion in February of 2022.
And as that war has continued and become this strange mix of an old-fashioned trench war and a futuristic drone war, we are continuing to try to figure out what Putin wants out of this. What do you think here in 2025 he's after? Is this all about NATO and NATO borders?
No, that's just a subterfuge.
Yeah.
I mean, he didn't object to NATO enlargement when it happened in 2004. He doesn't like NATO because if Ukraine were in NATO, Russia couldn't control it. And he wants to be able to control and absorb Ukraine. So what he's after is he still thinks he can win the war. He wants a Ukraine that's smaller, that's weaker, that's demilitarized, that will have to promise never to join NATO. And he wants regime change. He wants President Zelensky to go, and they would prefer to have someone in power in Kyiv that's more pro-Russian. But given what's happened in Ukraine in the last 3 years, that's going to be impossible to find.
It seems like you're kind of dismissing a lot of the things that Putin at least, again, says is different than actual view. He wants out of this war, despite President Trump's scolding on social media in recent weeks. He still seems to, by and large, support a lot of Russia's end goals suddenly. What is the strongest card that Ukraine has at this point? Or is Russia in a position to really dictate the end game of this war at this point?
Well, it's not in a position to dictate the end game, but Ukraine is in a weaker position in as much as the United States is now not supporting Ukraine, as the previous administration did. But the Europeans are stepping up. I mean, it'll take a lot more, but they do support Ukraine, and they believe that if Russia wins this war, then Europe itself will be threatened, and the likelihood of a wider war is there. So I think that's what they're trying to do. And you said in the beginning, this is on the one hand very old-fashioned trench warfare, but it's also very 21st century electronic warfare, cyber warfare, things like that. And the Ukrainians are getting pretty good. They're building their own drones. They're getting help with electronic warfare. So they may, going forward, be able to push the Russians back more than they are at the moment.
What do you think Putin wants out of the United States?
So there are two sets of negotiations going on. What Putin wants from the United States is the bilateral reset. I mean, President Trump has offered him something that no U.S. president really, since the collapse of the Soviet Union, has. They all tried resets, but they failed. But President Trump is saying we can have a fantastic economic relationship. We can end your isolation from the West. You can come back to all of these global fora. So and we will lift the sanctions. So those are the things that Putin wants. And I think he still believes he may be able to get this without making any real concessions on the Ukraine war, but stringing this along and having perpetual negotiations. There will be some more negotiations on Monday. Let's see what happens there. The Russians have been very evasive about what it is they're going to present. But that's what he wants. Mm-hmm. He wants the reestablishment of U.S.-Russian relations in a way that they haven't been since the 90s.
And stringing along, or as Trump memorably put it on social media, tapping him along. Does that benefit Russia at this point to you?
So I think the Russians are a little perplexed now, because if you look at some of the sort of propagandists in the media, they're now criticizing President Trump for being emotional, for being volatile and things like that. Mm-hmm. So they're concerned about what's happening. And that's why they keep dangling things like, OK, let's sit down and negotiate to prevent him from, in fact, either imposing sanctions. And there's a very tough sanctions bill in Congress. They don't want that sanctions bill. So they're trying to prevent that.
What's the best way to think about sanctions from your point of view? Have they worked? Have they weakened Russia? Because this is what, 3 years in of sanctions, and the war is continuing at the same pace it always has.
Well, they certainly haven't worked if they were supposed to change Putin's calculus. They have imposed costs on the Russian economy, but actually the most severe costs are happening now with low oil prices. And if the low oil prices continue and Russia's, you know, major revenue is from the sale of hydrocarbons, that would be much more serious. The problem is that there's been huge sanctions evasion. So part of this Senate bill that might be passed next week, it's veto-proof. I think it has 81 members supporting it. Would be to punish countries that are still trading and buying Russian oil, and to punish the people who help the sanctions and evasion. But that's all, it's very tricky. And that's the reason really why they haven't worked the way they were supposed to, is because so many countries are helping Russia evade them.
Like you said, peace talks are allegedly supposed to resume in Istanbul this upcoming week. Whether it's this round or the next round, what are the big questions you have? What will you be looking for to get a sense of whether Russia is serious in any way about these talks?
Well, I'd be looking at, what are the Russian demands? Are they changing, or are they still the maximum demands? They were supposed to present their memorandum of terms before the meeting. That hasn't happened. The Ukrainians, in fact, have presented theirs. So it's whether Russia is willing to make any modification to its maximum demands. And then, of course, whether the Ukrainians are willing to do that, too, because obviously they've rejected most of what Russia has suggested, although it's quite possible that Ukraine might accept some kind of a territorial compromise for the moment. But as long as they can continue to control those areas in the four so-called annexed territories that Ukraine, in fact, still controls.
Why do you think, from the American point of view, many presidents have tried wildly different approaches with Vladimir Putin over the last two decades? None of them seem to have really worked. Why do you think it's been so hard for any American president to rein in Vladimir Putin?
Because what Putin wants is a recognition by the United States that Russia has a right to a sphere of influence both in the post-Soviet space, but now in the former Warsaw Pact countries. In December of 21, two treaties were presented to the US and to NATO in the run-up to the war, and they essentially demanded that NATO return to the borders it had before the first enlargement when Poland, Hungary, and the Czech Republic joined. And that's what Putin has always wanted. He's wanted, in the words of one Russian expert, an equal partnership of unequals, and he hasn't gotten that.
Angela Stent is a professor emeritus at Georgetown and author of the book Putin's World, Russia Against the West and with the Rest. Thank you for taking the time with us today.
Thank you.
Pride Month is here, a time to recognize the LGBTQ community's history and impact. But the word pride didn't start out as a symbol for LGBTQ empowerment. NPR's Juliana Kim reports.
Pride was considered one of Christianity's seven deadly sins when it first appeared nearly a millennium ago. But within a few hundred years, the word took on a more positive spin, meaning a reasonable form of self-respect. Fast forward to the 1960s, the concept of gay pride started to emerge.
There was even a group in Los Angeles that was founded in 1966, so 3 years before Stonewall, that used PRIDE as its acronym. It stood for Personal Rights in Defense and Education.
That's Mark Stein, a history professor at San Francisco State University, who's written six books on LGBTQ history. He says gay activists were inspired by the terms Black Pride and Black Power used during the civil rights movement. Gay pride didn't really take off until after the Stonewall riots in 1969, when police raided a bar in New York City known to welcome gay patrons, sparking days of protests and becoming pivotal in the fight for LGBTQ rights. A few months later,
it was then, November 69, at this meeting of East Coast gay activists, that the decision was made we should have a march in New York and in other places on the anniversary of Stonewall.
There was debate about what the slogan should be. Some wanted gay power, but organizer L. Craig Shoemaker pushed for pride. He told The Illusionist in 2015, a few years before his death, that not everyone can have power, but anyone can have pride in themselves. It took a few more years, but soon the LGBT community rallied around the word and its meaning.
It had special resonance for LGBTQ people because the notion before the 70s that gay people were sinful, were diseased, were criminal was so powerful that many people internalized that.
The LGBTQ community has made significant strides since its original marches, but in recent years, they've experienced pushback from political and religious conservatives.
I think the strength of the backlash or the backsliding is a measure of how successful the movement had been for 50 years.
Stein adds that progress is rarely linear. Juliana Kim, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. In Boulder, Colorado, police say several people were injured by some type of flammable device as they marched in support of Israeli hostages held by Hamas at an outdoor market. Police say it's too early to speculate on a motive. including whether the group was the intended target. One man is in custody. The investigation by police and the FBI continues. The Senate returns from Memorial Day recess tomorrow, and topping its to-do list is President Trump's massive spending bill that just barely passed the House. Some Republican senators, though, say it can't pass in its current form. And at the weekend box office, Disney's Lilo and Stitch took the top spot again with an estimated $63 million in ticket sales. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions. Disclosures at RaymondJames.com. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its Sponsor Jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. From his attacks on universities to the slashing of federal research funding to the broadening crackdown on international students, a number of President Trump's actions have scientists questioning whether there is a future for them and their research in the United States. One researcher in Europe says this is an opportunity. In an article in the journal Nature, Maria Mota argues that European countries should seize this moment and bring concerned scientists to the EU. Mota is the executive director of the Gulbenkian Institute for Molecular Medicine in Lisbon, Portugal, and joins me now to talk more about this. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you so much for hosting me.
So you referred to New York to the United States as this beacon of research. Mm-hmm. We've talked to top academics in the U.S. in this moment about this, and they argue that for a century or so, the U.S. has held this unique role in international research. Have you seen it that way from your perspective?
Of course, no doubt about it. I think the United States have been a driver for the beacon, a driver, whatever term you want to use. We can be as positive as you want.
Yeah.
United States have been really the excellence of research. That saying, that we cannot say that there are not in other parts of the world, and of course Europe, but as a whole, United States have been, you know, have many centers of excellence, many centers of exceptional researchers. So it's really something that even for young people, you know, you are looking for to, mm-hmm. you know, to be there.
And yet in this moment, you've written that you have received 10 times the normal amount of inquiries mm-hmm. from scientists in the U.S. asking about job opportunities. Mm-hmm. What are they telling you? Why are they reaching out to you?
So they are worried. I think established people, people that are obviously established in certain research centers, probably they are worried with the future of US, but the ones that are establishing now, you know, are very worried there will be opportunities or not. And I think now many of these young that are transitioned from a postdoc that usually is a period that we develop after doing our PhDs, they are worried that these opportunities will not be there, I think. Some of them that have just done this transition in the past couple of years are now still very worried that, you know, their career cannot really fully flourish mm-hmm. in the environment that is being created. And I think these doubts, this anxiety makes people start to look for other opportunities.
You have written this is a once in a generation opportunity for the EU to recruit American scientists. What do you think the most important thing that EU countries need to do in this moment is?
I'm talking about more funding and a better ecosystem that things move fast, mm-hmm. that, you know, researchers that want to come here will not have visa problems for 6 or 8 months. This would be one type of problem. People that are entrepreneurs and they have good ideas and would love to develop, you know, ideas into companies, this and that, would have their life facilitated and will have a type of fundings that come from public and private that will allow them to do this. But I also would like to leave a message that is very clear. When I say that we should seize this opportunity, I'm not saying that we are happy, and we are not at all happy of what is happening in the United States. I think it would be so much better to have the United States continuing to be a beacon. Mm-hmm. But it's true that at the moment what you are happening is that we have really bright minds that don't know what will be the next years in their lives. And I think, you know, we should give them
an aunt. We should give them an opportunity. What we want is the entire world, of course, produce knowledge. But I think now, as the moment is, and with so many scientists really having, you know, this lack of opportunities in a part of the world that used to be full of opportunities, I think Europe needs to, I really hope that they feel that is the push that they needed to really go back to an environment that, you know, allows scientists to make the biggest discoveries in the world.
That is Maria Mota, Executive Director of the Gulbenkian Institute for Molecular Medicine in Lisbon. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Summer is underway, if not in the calendar, in our hearts. Memorial Day weekend just happened. We are in the summer movie season. For a lot of us, summer is defined just as much by what is playing in the theater as it is by the pool and the barbecues and vacations. But just what defines a summer movie? And what are some of the best ones? To discuss this very important topic, we have brought in All Things Considered producers Mark Rivers. Hey, Mark.
Hey, Scott.
And Avery Keatley. Hey, Avery.
Hey.
So, Mark, I will start with you. I want to get to both of you. When you think about what makes a summer movie, what do you think about? What are the key ingredients?
I mean, you mentioned vacation up top, right? And I feel like the movies are kind of the cheapest, easiest way to go on vacation. I think a great summer movie is kind of like going on vacation.
Settle into that air conditioning.
Settle into the air conditioned space and just let go, right? And I feel like with the summer, right, there's kind of an air of possibility almost. You hope to experience something wonderful, something memorable.
And you're kind of like trying to get back in touch with your younger self if you're an adult.
Exactly. And I think with a good summer movie, there's also that air of possibility and excitement.
Avery, what about you? What are the key themes, ingredients?
Yeah, I mean, I think similarly to Mark, like, this is a time where I want to be transported through the movies. This is not the time of year when I want to sit down and watch something like really intense or bleak or, you know, kind of claustrophobic. I want to go on a journey. I want to go on an adventure, whether that's hopping around the world with Indiana Jones, mm-hmm. or we're going on a mission with Barbie, or even like doing a heist in Ocean's 11.
No, like English Patient, no Schindler's List.
No, nothing, and like there's nothing wrong with those movies. I do like those experiences. But when I walk out of the theater in the summer, I want to feel buoyant, right? Yeah. Like I want to feel joyous and that nothing has weighed me down.
Yeah. I think the only thing I would add to what both of you are saying is like when it's going well, it creates kind of a zeitgeisty fun moment that you can connect with and talk about with. Like I feel like Barbie totally. Was a recent example. Yeah. Like everybody had thoughts on Barbie. Everybody saw Barbie.
Hey, Barbie.
Yeah.
Can I come to your house tonight?
Sure. I don't have anything big planned. Just a giant blowout party with all the Barbies and planned choreography and a bespoke song. You should stop by.
And I feel like increasingly that beat is harder and harder to find. But like to me, that's kind of a classic. Like this is a movie that defined the summer. That was
the Barbenheimer summer, which I was going to get to later. But I mean, Barbenheimer was all about the movies as a communal experience. Right? Yeah. Like we all kind of experienced that together. And it was a rare example of two big event movies that weren't sequels and they weren't about people in caves.
The world will remember this day.
I have some trivia for you. What do you think was the last year where a list of top 10 highest grossing movies of the summer, there wasn't one sequel or one superhero movie? Could you guess what year? This is based off of Box Office Mojo.
Oh my gosh. I'm going to say 2004.
I was going to put it around there, 2007.
1996. And the top movie was Independence Day. Wow. Another great summer movie.
Wow.
We'll get back to that in a moment.
Yeah.
Independence Day specifically. But to that end, I feel like let's talk about what defines a summer movie, right? Like, I feel like you can have a few different camps. You can have the big budget spectacles, Transformers, superhero movies. I will say, I specifically remember walking into a theater to watch Independence Day for the first time and having it just like packed with people who were ready to like scream at the screen. And that is just like a very key movie memory in my brain.
Back when Will Smith was slapping aliens and not people.
Yes.
Yeah. Look at you! Ship all banged up! Who's the man? Huh? Who's the man?
Punching aliens.
Yeah.
So you've got that. You've got kind of the classic genre-y movie where summer is a key part of the plot. Mark, you produced a very important piece of journalism we did last year when we talked to people from American Pie. And that is one classic example of just like summer vacation things happen. Like, what are some of your favorite films in these categories, Avery?
If we're talking about blockbusters, I think we've got to start with the original, which is Jaws. Jaws is
the prototypical blockbuster.
It really is. And I think, I mean, Jaws, I feel like, delivers in so many ways. It is my hands down favorite summertime movie. It deals with summertime things, right? We're at the beach. We're worried about swimming because there's sharks. There's a monster. There's like this fun tension, but it's also just very kind of light. And honestly, like, I just think the writing in Jaws is really good, right?
Yeah. But you don't come out of it thinking most of the creature. You know, you remember the character.
Yeah, the characters really are the ones, like, who are driving it.
Some amazing monologues.
Yeah, there's this particularly famous scene with Captain Quint, who's played by Robert Shaw. He tells this war story that really reveals as much about him as it reveals about what they are up against.
You know the thing about a shark? He's got lifeless eyes. Black eyes, like a doll's eyes. When he comes at you, doesn't seem to be living until he bites you in those black eyes.
I was too young to deal with the emotional intensity of this monologue.
That's fair. I mean, it is an intense monologue, but I feel like it sets the stakes of what they're up against so well.
Yeah.
I think it just really delivers as an adventure movie that you go on with these characters.
So that's one. Avery, I know you want to talk about another movie that is wildly different than Jaws, but perhaps not as widespread appreciation, but those who know, they know.
Yeah, I think that's a fair way to put it. You know, I know I said that I don't usually do heavier, intense movies in summer, but this is a go-to summer movie for me, and it does involve a ritual human sacrifice.
Now, those children out there, they're jumping through the flames in the hope that the god of fire will make them fruitful. Really, you can hardly blame them.
So that is Christopher Lee in the original 1973 Wicker Man, directed by Robin Hardy. Not to be confused with the 2006 remake starring Nick Cage.
The Wicker Man, it's just an insane movie. There's no, right?
Like,
it's,
summers can get kind of crazy, though. So it kind of, I think it fits, right?
But summer is a key part of it.
Summer is a key part of it. And yes, it is so delightfully weird. And it only gets weirder the longer you watch it, right? It takes place on Summer Isle with this fictional island off of the Scottish coast. And the inhabitants are just kind of bizarre people who routinely break out into, like, somewhat menacing songs.
Yes.
And on that tree there was a limb, and on that limb there was a branch, and on that branch there was a nest, and in that nest there was an egg.
It's not quite Dua Lipa, but it could be a bop. It could be a season.
There's some good songs in here, man. I mean, they'll stick in your brain. But it's just, it sort of like just raises the level of kind of creepiness where they're constantly kind of singing about what they're doing and what their belief system is. Mm-hmm. It just creeps in at the edges that something is like really weird
too
here.
Too many folks frolicking and like in the
middle. Yeah, singing yeah. And like way too many puffy sleeves and skirts and
Mark, I know it's hard to follow Jaws and The Wicker Man. But...
yeah, I mean, definitely co-signing Jaws. I mean, but if you went kind of intense, I'll go a little bit intense. And I think one movie that to me just embodies the summer, where I watch it and I feel the heat emanating off the screen, and it's Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing, which I know we talked about trying to escape from burdens, and Do the Right Thing is very much kind of about the things that burden social life. But it's an example of a movie that can make heavy social issues fun and entertaining and colorful. And when I think about the summer where people just, they're outside and they come alive. And Do the Right Thing is just alive. You know, like Giancarlo Esposito's character bugging out. You got Rosie Perez's character. You have the DJ played by Samuel L. Jackson. He's kind of just providing this constant commentary across the movie.
Doing the yin and the yang, the hip and the hop, the stupid fresh thing, the flippity flop. Oh! I have today's forecast for you. Hot!
These are just such larger-than-life and colorful figures, and it just puts me in that summertime mood of just anything can happen, and emotions are high, and people are sweating, and they're exhausted, and summertime can be exciting, but it's also exhausting. But my lighter choice, the choice that I also watch every summer, is Magic Mike XXL. Not the first one, but the second one.
The sequel, at the beginning, you know, you were kind of ripping on sequels.
We've broken every rule we started this conversation with, I just want to say.
Sometimes the summertime is about breaking rules.
You know what?
So
I
think
that.
It fits. And you might call Magic Mike XXL the Godfather Part 2 of male stripper movies.
When you say you might, it seems like you do.
I do. Yeah. I would call just it the Godfather Part 2 of male stripper movies.
I got a little treat for y'all tonight. It's a man I knew as White Chocolate. Some might know him as Magic Mike.
This movie is just a good time distilled. It's like if you just like injected it into your veins, like it's just a great time. A magical portrait of untoxic masculinity. Just like dudes just enjoying their time together.
What are you? You're not a fireman.
I'm a male entertainer.
Oh yeah, what are we?
It's a movie that's unapologetically about pleasure and desire and just being liberated. It has no story to speak of, because what summer vacation does have a story, really? It's kind of plotless, but it is constant motion and constant fun. That's what I want out of a summer, and that's what I want out of a movie.
That was NPR's Mark Rivers and Avery Keatley. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Scott.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. In Boulder, Colorado today, several people were attacked and burned on the Pearl Street Mall. Authorities say a man has been taken into custody. Boulder Police Chief Stephen Redfern described what his officers found as they responded to the incident.
When we arrived, we encountered multiple victims that were injured with injuries consistent with burns and other injuries.
Talking to reporters, Redfern said it was too soon to describe a motive to the incident. Megan Verley from Colorado Public Radio is on the line with us now. Megan, thanks for joining us in the story. Let's start with this. What do we know?
Well, obviously, details are still really coming out, but what we understand so far is that the suspect who's been arrested allegedly threw something flammable onto people there at the Pearl Street Mall. A number of people were burned, some pretty seriously. The suspect was arrested. What the police say at this point that it's too soon to talk officially about a motive. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of people, including our governor and our state attorney general, who believe this was a targeted attack. There was a group in the area at the time, part of a national organization called Run for Their Lives, that gets out and walks every week to draw attention to hostages still being held by Hamas. And it was members of that group, from what we understand, who were attacked. And so there's a lot of feeling this was probably not a random incident.
So this was a regular march for hostages. And again, the local police are saying it's too early to tell motive, though a suspect's in custody. What do we know about the condition of the victims?
Well, the police said that their injuries range from very severe to not too serious. Two of them were taken rapidly to the main hospital outside of Denver, which suggests that they are needing a very high level of care.
What has the FBI said so far? You told us before just a little bit. Can you give us a little more detail on what federal authorities are saying at this point?
Yes. Yeah, so Kash Patel, the head of the FBI, was really actually probably the first to publicly label it terrorism. He posted this afternoon that we are aware of and fully investigating a targeted terror attack in Boulder, Colorado, and that FBI is on the scene already looking into it. So the FBI certainly seems to think that this was terrorism.
Again, as local officials are saying, it's too soon to know the exact details, but it does feel worth pointing out. This comes a bit more than a week after a targeted shooting of Israeli embassy employees in Washington, D.C., other increased threats against Jewish people. What do we know about the group that was holding the event that you were telling us about?
Well, so they've been doing this every week since the winter. Today was a particularly nice day weather-wise. I don't know if that would have brought more people out. I was hearing a Boulder City Councilwoman being interviewed who said that she knew people who were injured in that attack and that this is really being felt in Boulder's Jewish community, that this is a town where the debate over the war in Gaza has been very active and at times very personal. Mm-hmm. And so this is being felt by a lot of people and has frightened a lot of people.
Megan Verley from Colorado Public Radio, thank you so much for your reporting on this.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Trump administration no longer recommends COVID vaccines for pregnant women or kids who are healthy, which means people who still want the shots may not be covered by insurance.
It feels like I've had a choice taken away from me.
How parents respond to a new policy, tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Janine Herbst with these headlines. Ukrainian drones hit deep into Russia today, hitting several airfields and destroying more than 40 military planes. Meanwhile, Russia struck a Ukrainian military training unit, leaving at least 12 soldiers dead. This ahead of scheduled peace talks in Istanbul tomorrow. The Senate returns for Memorial Day recess tomorrow, and topping its to-do list is President Trump's massive spending bill that just barely passed the House. They're under pressure to pass it quickly, but some Republican senators say it can't pass in its current form. And at the weekend box office, Disney's Lilo and Stitch took the top spot again with an estimated $63 million. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. President Trump says he is close to a deal with Iran over their nuclear program. The talks picked back up in April, nearly 7 years after Trump unilaterally pulled out of the previous agreement, which had been negotiated by President Obama. But Trump's confidence of a deal comes at an interesting time. Yesterday, the United Nations nuclear watchdog put out a report saying that Iran has dramatically increased its uranium stockpile since February. Syed Hussein Mousavian was part of Iran's nuclear negotiation team in the early 2000s. He's now a Middle East security and nuclear policy specialist at Princeton University. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Let's start here. What do you think the state of these talks are, and why do you think this moment is so important?
First of all, to my understanding, Scott, I think they have three major issues to negotiate and to agree. The first and the most important is about verification measures. The U.S. expects Iran to accept the highest level of transparency and verification measures and cooperate with the International Atomic Energy Agency in order to remove the technical ambiguities. Mm-hmm. The second major issue is about the stockpile of high-level enriched uranium at the level of 60%. The IAEA report yesterday says Iran has 400 kilograms of 60% enriched uranium, which is enough for making 10 nuclear bombs. Mm-hmm. And this is, I think, a very, very important and urgent issue for the U.S. to address. The third major issue, Scott, I think, is about the enrichment. To my understanding, the two parties, they may have agreed on the number one and number two, and they have a problem on number three because the U.S. is asking Iran to forego enrichment, to dismantle the enrichment industry, and Iran says, it is my red line.
I'm curious what you make of the U.S.'s role in all of this and how the U.S. is approaching these negotiations, because on one hand, you've seen with tariffs,
President Trump change his mind every other day, be incredibly volatile and not really give a clear long-term goal. And then on the other hand, these nuclear talks have been progressing for several months now in kind of what seems from the outside like a low-key, forward-moving way. How do you think the U.S. is approaching this? What sticks out to you?
The problem, Scott, Iranians, they have with the U.S. is that they really cannot trust the U.S. in case a deal is agreed, the U.S. would not cheat. That's why even now, Iranians, they have the same problem because, to my understanding, I heard from some sources which I can trust. They told me in the first and the second and even the third round of nuclear talks between Steve Witkoff and Abbas Araghchi, they agreed on the principles orally, and it was all about verification measures. And suddenly, I mean, we read in the news that Prime Minister Netanyahu called President Trump and the U.S. changed its position from verification to zero enrichment. And now Iranians, they say, look, we have had 2-3 rounds of negotiations in Oman, in Rome, and we agreed on the principles. Suddenly, the U.S. changed its position. And even if there is an agreement, how we can trust the U.S.? Would be committed to its word to signature to agreement.
Given all of that, what do you think the U.S.'s motivation has been to try and seriously craft a new deal, given how many times, many of the key members of this administration walked away from previous ones? Is it just the fact that Iran has been so cornered over the past few years?
See, from one side, the reality is that Iran has been damaged, trillions of dollars on economic damages because of the sanctions. On the regional issues, there are some setbacks. No one can deny this, Scott. I mean, but from the other side, Iran has increased the level and the capacity of enrichment. Now Iran is a nuclear threshold state, and Iran has just 2 weeks to break out, and Iran has material to make 10 nuclear bombs. And I think now President Trump understands that with sanctions, he cannot bring regime change. And the sanction regime change is not a good policy, and the U.S. has not achieved its main objective. Therefore, it's better to go with international rules and regulations, IAEA, NPT, to make a very, very transparent deal to make sure that Iran would have never have nuclear bomb, and then open the relation for big economic cooperations, which I think this is the best policy.
That is Syed Hossein Mousavian, former Iran nuclear negotiator. Thank you so much for helping us understand this moment.
Thank you, Scott.
This past week, endurance swimmer Lewis Pugh became the first person to swim around the island of Martha's Vineyard. It was a nearly 60-mile swim that he completed over 12 days. Battling frigid water, rough winds, and the constant thought of what might have been lurking beneath him. Great white sharks migrate through the waters around Martha's Vineyard during the summer, and the island was also the filming location for the movie Jaws, which turns 50 this year. To Pugh, it was a perfect opportunity.
It was a movie which has shaped the narrative about sharks for 50 years.
Every couple of years, Pugh tackles an extreme swim to raise awareness for marine life and the delicate ecosystems of our waterways. I asked him how he got started.
I did my first big swim when I was 17 years old. I swam from Robben Island back to Cape Town, and it was a really tough swim as a young kid. And I remember putting my feet down at the end on the sand and thinking to myself, wow, this has challenged me. This was something very, very special. I knew right at that moment that I had found a sport which I have adored. And so every single year, I have tried to do a swim which is a bit harder, a bit tougher, a bit colder. It wasn't like I was 17 years old and I thought, okay, one day I want to do a swim around Martha's Vineyard.
What was uniquely challenging about Martha's Vineyard?
The thing which made Martha's Vineyard a tough swim was a combination of factors. The water was very cold, there were constant waves, and the wind blew for 10 days, and then the distance. The other thing which made it tough was that in nearly 40 years of swimming, we've always had a rule in my team, and that is we never talk about sharks. Because if you talk about sharks, and very, very soon you're going to be thinking about sharks, and if you're thinking about sharks, then you're going to get nervous in the water, and very, very soon you'll be out of the water. But on this swim, it attracted so much media attention from all over the world. So I was speaking about sharks all day long. So you can imagine what I was thinking about when I actually got into the water later in the day to do my swim.
So the idea was, I'll swim around Martha's Vineyard, where much of Jaws was filmed, and I'll show that it's safe to do.
So it's not so much that I was out there to show that it's safe or to show that you can go out and hug a shark. What I'm trying to show is what is happening to sharks. So globally, the data is very, very shocking. So on average, 274,000 sharks are killed globally every single day. I mean, it's complete madness. It's an ecocide. It's happening right now. I mean, you take those numbers, 274,000 every single day, and you multiply that over a year, it's 100 million sharks are killed globally every year.
Since you weren't, as you say, hugging sharks, can you tell us about some of the precautions you took to make sure you were safe doing the swim?
Yeah, so I had a kayaker right next to me, and then I also had a boat very, very close to me, and everybody kept a good lookout for sharks, especially when we came among seals. So you know that when you've got seals in the water, not far away, they're going to be sharks. And Cape Cod now has become a global hotspot for great white sharks.
This is an interesting point, though, because you're talking about wanting to raise awareness and protect sharks, and yet there's a very real concern that you have when you're swimming in open water about them and making sure you're doing it safely.
Absolutely. You know, I'm normal. I'm frightened of sharks, okay? I remember the first time I saw Jaws was I was probably a 12-year-old boy, and I remember the music, the soundtrack. It was so frightening. But now, having swum for so many years, I'm now terrified of a world without sharks, because a world without sharks is a world where the ocean isn't in balance.
And yet at the same time, you were very happy to not directly run into one during the swim.
If you're going to be an endurance swimmer and you're going to swim in places like Martha's Vineyard or the Cape of Good Hope or the Red Sea, you will encounter them. And here's the rub. When you see a shark, it's actually a magnificent thing to see. They're really beautiful, right? They have survived 5 mass extinctions. They're older than the dinosaurs. We need to educate ourselves about these animals. We need to respect them, and we need to protect them. And when you see a shark in the ocean, it's a wonderful sight, because you know that that's a healthy ecosystem.
That is endurance swimmer Lewis Pugh. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you so much.
And finally today, the singer Obong Jar has a new album out. It's called Paradise Now. The Nigerian-born singer, who moved to the UK when he was a teenager, says he draws inspiration from all over the world, and that was on full display in this album. We caught up with him to learn more about the process of making the album and to hear about a few standout tracks.
The funny thing about Moonan is that it's about another LA love of mine, and someone I'd known for a very long time.
Moonlight, you look so sweet, laying here right next to me.
I just watched the sun hit her face, and it was one of those beautiful mornings where you look at someone and you just realizing them, all the things that she'd done for me and how good a friend she'd been to me, and maybe how horrible I might have been to her. Not horrible, but not as good a friend to her as she was to me. Just appreciating her in that moment. I wanted to write something to let her know that I actually really did appreciate her as a person, as a friend, as someone in my life.
Out of nowhere you swept me, my flaws are many, my scars are heavy, took down my armor so delicately.
You better
How you find yourself a number? No backbone, jellyfish.
Jellyfish, I think I wrote it at a time when Rishi Sunak was Prime Minister in the UK, and this is just in the early stages of the war in Palestine. This is something I could not respect, especially with the situation that was going on and how brutal the whole thing has been. I was really, really mad at the whole situation, and I just wrote a song about it, calling out the British government for their stance on the war in Palestine. Lyrically, you don't have to write in a particular type of way to get your point across or to say something. You just need to say, be how you are and speak how you speak and say what you would say, rather than try to twist and turn and go around in circles. I think it was very important for me to be very direct and straight to the point. So I think that's what I learned making this record. Just My Luck, I mean, I guess I've been writing Just My Luck for a long time, just through different stages of my life and trying to come to terms with missing out on things and not getting the things that I thought I wanted at certain times in my life. The melody of it and the music of it is quite nice, fun, happy-go-lucky song, but deep within it, it's almost like a realization of not necessarily getting what you want. And it's sad when you don't get the things that you want. It's not a nice feeling. Recognizing that those things might not necessarily be things that you need in life, you know? So it's like that kind of like contrast. I learned that room for magic, man. Make room for magic. Let it. You can't control every single aspect of it. It was more about having fun and just being in the moment, creating music.
That was singer Obong Jayar talking about his new album, Paradise Now. It's out now. For Sunday, that's All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Scott Detrow. Hope you had a great start to your June. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you again soon.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Made in Cookware. Made in Cookware is crafted by chefs for use in restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at madeincookware.com. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, telling stories behind data and trends that shape our world today through its podcast, After the Fact. Learn more at pewtrusts.org/afterthefact. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.